Thank you for joining us this evening for the Maoisting Show. This is part one of a two-part interview with Juanita Blackhawk.
I'm Shirley Nordrum.
And I'm Sharon Nordrum.
And today we're visiting with Juanita Blackhawk. She is a quill artist who learned from the master.
The master, Melvin Lush.
There we
Hopefully
go.
Hopefully I'll see him later this evening.
Thank you for joining us today, Juanita.
Uh-huh.
So our show is about, you know, visiting cool people about the cool things that they do. And, yeah, and then, like, the listeners get to kind of almost like they're eavesdropping on a kitchen table conversation.
Hey, that's a little part. Yeah, that's a little part.
They can't be part of it. It's not interactive, hey. So I guess they're eavesdropping, but... I don't know.
For a moment, they're a fly on the wall.
Yeah, yeah. It's your moment to be a fly on the wall when you listen to our show.
Hey, hey.
So cool. You want to tell us how you got started in your art? And
oh, my goodness. Well, let's start with introducing myself the proper way.
All right.
Gnome Gwano Kwey in the Shinnakas. Gawi Babi Gari Kug. Ishkonagin and Dojiba. Mong in Dodain. My name is Golden Eagle Feather Woman. I'm from the White Earth Reservation. And the Loon is my clan. Way back. Early 90s, late 80s, early 90s, I saw this beautiful chair that was all quilled. It used to be in the Chiwi here at Cass Lake.
The chair.
And I was fascinated with it. I wanted to learn. And I found out who did the chair, where he lived, and just never connected with him right away. And that was in my drinking days. Well, I quit drinking because I wanted to learn quill work.
Awesome.
I was living out in Sugar Point. And I was working at the gas station grocery store in Federal Dam. Dolly and Kurt Kottmeyer owned it. Dolly Gale. God, I miss her. Melvin came into the store one night to get cigarettes. As I'm handing back his cigarettes and change, I went, Mr. Lush, would you consider teaching me quill work? He looks at me, grabs a cigarette and chain, heads towards the door. He gets one step out. He turns around. Be at my house tomorrow, 8 o'clock. I'm starting a class. And out the door he goes. The next morning, yeah, I was there about 7:45. And he taught me and four other women. There was five of us. And the only name I still remember was Dorothy Jenkins because she was all crippled up with arthritis. Her hands were, you know, in all curled up like claws. And she did the most beautiful work, just beautiful. But he taught all of us how to do the quill boxes. And when he started us, he just gave us a paper bag. All filled up with quills. But he plucked off of the porcupine. He said, start sorting. Now, what? So he showed us what we were supposed to do. And we sat there and sorted quills, putting them in a bowl. And he'd look, no, you need more. Like the whole first day was sorting quills. And the next day we came back and he got out the birch bark. And he had us cut out circles. And then we picked what design we were going to use. And mine, I believe the first one was at End of the Trail. And I did that one. I didn't like it. and our first one we have to give away. But, yeah. He taught me everything. I mean, even after the class was done and we had made our first quill boxes, I kept going back to him, learning everything I could. I asked him one time, how do you dye the quills? Ancient Indian secret. So I'm thinking berries and roots and bark and all kinds of things.
Root dye.
Yeah. He just ripped. And it's got to be liquid rich. Why? Because if you use the powder and you don't rinse it good enough, you end up with rainbow mouth.
Well, I can tell you that now he uses powder.
Yeah, but working, I keep them in my mouth to keep them soft. So yeah, if you don't rinse them good enough, yeah, you do end up with all the dye in your mouth. And I've done that quite a few times. But yeah, he taught me how to gather the birch bark and... He had this refrigerator at the house. This was before I learned how to get the birch bark. And I opened it up to get something to drink, and it was nothing but birch bark. You keep it in a freezer. It's like fresh off of the tree when it thaws out. And when we asked him how much, I asked him, actually, how much I owe him for teaching me. And he says, when you get good enough, you teach it. Okay. I didn't think I'd ever get good enough. But I did. I started teaching it. And I've been doing it ever since. And I lost count 200 and some students. I know there's more than that. But my sister, Marcy Rendon, and an associate from the U of M came up 2011, somewhere in there. And they went around to all the reservations and interviewed the Native artists to see their supplies easy to get Are there good venues to sell your stuff? How long have you been doing your art? How many have you taught? You know, stuff like that. And she did my own sister interviewing me. That was tough. But I hooked her up with a lot of the different artists that I know. And we met at Cadillac's. That was before it was the bar. It was the coffee shop then.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so it's been a while. You know when it switched over. And I love Richard to death, but hey, should have kept it just a coffee bar, dude. And who do we have there? Punk Wakanabo, Teresa. Anyway, a lot of artists from Lee's Lake we gathered there. But Melvin didn't come. So my sister Marcy went out to his house to do his interview. She said she knocked on the door, he opened it, and just stared at her. And she goes, I'm Marcy Rendon, and I called you. I'm going to do the interview. And he just kept staring at her. And she goes, yes, I'm Juanita's older sister. And she's still doing quill work. She started pulling out pictures to show him because she was scared he wouldn't do the interview. And during the interview, she asked him all the questions, asked him how long he had been doing his work. And at the time, I think it was like close to 30 years. And during that time, how many of you taught? And he said, 7. The next question was, out of the 7, how many have continued? 1. At that point, my sister pulled out the interview that she did of me and let him read it. And she said, I've never seen a bigger smile on somebody's face when he saw that I had taught over 200 students, 200 people. And out of those, I know for sure there's about 35 that are still doing it.
That's really good.
Yeah. It was even better when I found out later that he started teaching again. I was so happy. And she let me read his, and all I could do was cry. I'm the only one out of all that he's taught. And it just, I mean, if you know anything about Melvin, you know how he is, and he's just so awesome. That's all I can say.
I wonder, though, my thoughts go to, and he would never know, but, sometimes people go and learn things, and it really isn't until later in life that they really realize what they learned, and then they pick it back up again at a different time. But, the master's not there to help them at that time, or not sitting right with them anyway, and they may have questions and things like that. So I'm wondering if people,
I'm still in the same house, you know where I live, come back.
If you had interest enough to ask, I'm thinking that maybe you were interested.
Uh-huh.
Of the original 5 of us, Shirley was the only one for many years that would do it every once in a while because of her arthritis. Her husband would help her. And she was Ann Dunn's, I want to say sister-in-law or sister, one of the two, no, sister-in-law. And Ann came out to camp one time, our indigenous camps on White Earth, and she had this blue tub, plastic tub. And she set it down in front of me and she says, Juanita, you can make better use of this than I can. I opened it up and started crying. It was all of Shirley's stuff. When she passed away, her husband gave it to Ann Dunn and Ann passed it on to me. And she's working with one of the mongooses. All. That pokey thing that we used to poke the holes in the birch bark. And yeah, I mean, I just sat there and cried. She was the only one that we knew of. Out of us original ones. And yeah, I amaze myself on some of the designs that I do, and what some of my students do. Some of them surpass the teacher sometimes. And I know how Melvin feels.
Do you do a lot of boxes?
Oh, yes. I'm working on 5 of them right now.
Is that artist ADD again?
Uh-huh.
Jumping from one thing to the next?
Well, it's orders. People have ordered these. Okay. My foster parents, who had me from the time I was 15 till I was 18, we've reconnected. And every other year or so, they stop by and visit. Well, this year they decided they wanted one for my little sister, one for my little brother, and one for them. And then I've got to do one for Bob Shimmick and one for a friend of mine up in Door County, Wisconsin. She's got a woman up there that wants one to put her son's ashes in. So that, I'm working on that one, trying to get that one done
first, probably.
Yes. Yeah. Even though Bob's, I promised him it would be done a couple weeks ago. But he knows how it is.
Yeah, he does. You'll
especially with all my doctor appointments and other stuff. He's cool. And he's known me umpteen million years, too. So.
People are pretty laid back when it comes to stuff like that.
Well, they know that.
If you're an artist,
they know how much work goes into it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because the way Melvin did it, it took us 4 days to do a box.
And that's working steady.
Every day.
Yep. Mm-hmm. That's like 8-9 hours a day working on a box.
Yeah. And when I moved back to Pine Point, which is where my husband's family is from, and I call that my village, and my mother-in-law would send over one of my nieces. Auntie, you eating yet? No. Okay. And then she'd go, in come my mother-in-law, push everything out of the way, set down a big bowl of rabbit soup with dumplings, and she stood right there with her arms crossed, standing over me. Eat. Okay. Because I would sit up all day and all night until I got it done, whatever it was I was doing. And she'd always send one of the kids over to make sure I'd eat. Because I tend to forget to do that when I'm working. And it's like, because, like I tell people when they ask me, why do you do your quill work? Because it's kept my sanity and my sobriety since 1990. That was when I started remembering, when I sobered up, I remembered the sexual abuse from the time I was 4 until I was 15, when I left my adoptive home. And I immerse myself in that quill work, and I can forget about all of that. And I use that to bring people's stories out. I tell mine, then I hear theirs. For the Minnesota Indian Women's Sexual Assault Coalition, MUSAC, I do a workshop, Healing Through the Arts. And for a while, I was using the quill work. I've switched over to using spoken word and poetry. And it's phenomenal what these women write, let me tell you, to get their stories out for the first time.
I bet.
Oh, yeah. Mm. But, and I mean, I've done a lot of spoken word poetry. I've done plays. I've done quite a bit of everything.
So do you think that, do you have any, this is interesting to me because this is like a previous interview that we did where we talked about art therapy and then it led into poetry, which is, I'm doing a deja vu thing here. But so do you think that the poetry probably helps the victim get their story out better, but do you think that there's still a place for the quill work to help them get lost in,
healing?
So the combination of the two,
whether it's quill work or bead work, I've done bead work too, or making a dance outfit, whatever your art form is, use it. And that's what I tell them. And for the conference, it's just to bring those stories out, because we've had a lot of people there that it's the first time they've ever told anybody about their abuse.
Yeah, I was at a, that can be quite the experience to hear that. Where in the heck was I? I was somewhere where a woman did that. She wrote a poem about her experience, and then she read it for the first time right there and started, you know, the emotional, the crying. It was hard for her to finish that, and I think it was equally as painful for the audience to see the, not only hear the expression, but to see the pain coming out. It was like this whole...
You just want to wrap your arms around them.
We do that at MUSAC. After the last day, kind of, we have open mic. So if you want to read what you wrote, you can do that. And the emotion is, you know, and it's like the minute they're done, somebody's there to hug them, you know, and as they're coming further to where they were seated, more people are hugging. And how many did I have that first time? 5, I think. Yeah. And this last year, everybody in the class got up there.
Woo! The power of the healing, they probably, the word of mouth that, you know, once you let go of that and put that pain back in, you know, put it into the universe, and it can just...
Then you can start the healing process.
Yes. And that's what what I say. It's that first step on that healing journey. You've got to make that first step. And whatever it is, whatever you use to do that, whether it's journaling, poetry, spoken word, beadwork, quill work, dance outfits, moccasins, whatever, or drawing, painting, whatever it is, use that as your therapy. I mean, I remember some of the things when I was younger that I drew.
Kind of dark? Were you a dark artist?
Yeah. And not only that, but being 4, 5, 6 years old and remembering and drawing what he was making me do, you know? And, I didn't really remember that sketchbook, but my older sister did, because I showed it to her when I was 14, because we were moving out to Washington. And I kind of buried all of it all, you know? Drugs, alcohol, the whole nine yards. And when I quit the drugs, quit the drinking, was when I started remembering. And the first person I call was my sister. Call the guys in the white coats because I'm losing it. I have to have all the lights on in the house. I double, triple check the windows, the doors. There's chairs under the doorknobs. I'm going nuts. And she says, no, you're not. You're starting to remember. And she says, get a hold of a sexual assault advocate. Linda Reese.
Yeah.
From Walker. Phenomenal woman. And she worked with me a lot to get some of those memories out. I still haven't remembered all of it. It sneaks up on me once in a while. But I can tell when it is now. Thanks to Priscilla Day. She was my shrink that Linda got me in to see when she was right here in Cass Lake. And the first thing Priscilla said, when's the last time you had a sweat? God, years. Go have a sweat. Find a sweat. Then come back and talk to me. And that's what more and more of our people need to do.
Mm-hmm.
That's part of the healing. And I'm a big advocate of that. And we work with a group called Wellness in the Woods. It's the only consumer-run mental health organization in Minnesota. We have all been diagnosed with a mental issue.
Mental health issue.
Yes. Thank you. You know, I've got PTSD. I was diagnosed with that a long time ago, you know, with the anxiety and the panic attacks. PTSD over here, anxiety and panic. All of us that are on that board and the staff have all been diagnosed with something. And we're bringing it to rural Minnesota. We're kind of a go-between. We try to get trainings on, oh God, do I, RAP, Wellness and Recovery Action Plan, QPR, Question, Persuade, Refer. Suicide prevention, WISH, wellness and senior health, mental health first aid.
For both adults and children.
And children, yep. Team RAP, like...
For organizations.
For organizations, thank you. She's been in there a little bit longer than me. So that's, you know, and I'm doing that not for myself, too, is learning how to do things better and how to help others better.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I've been doing that, oh my gosh, since the 90s, going into schools.
So did this go hand in hand with the quill work, with your sobriety and everything coming mm-hmm. to light? Because mm-hmm. you said the quill work was the 90s, too.
Yeah, so, quill work was the 90s. I sobered up in the 90s.
It was a package deal.
It sure was.
Yeah. Just changed your whole life.
It did. It did. It opened my eyes to a lot of things.
Well, it sounds like it changed the lives of a lot of people because, you know, you're helping a lot of people through the art therapy mm-hmm. and spoken word and all the things that you're doing. You know, I think that so many of us are broken. I'm not sure that there isn't, if there's someone that isn't broken, but...
I know, and she anybody, said everybody had a mental... It was like, don't we all have a mental
Well, that's just
issue?
It. And those of us that are enrolled in a tribe, we all have the generational trauma. And that's handed down from way back here to us. You know, because you start looking back, you got the forced adoption era. ICWA came into play because of that era. That's my era. The one before that is the boarding school era, right? Mm-hmm. Before that was the reservations, getting displaced, the relocation. You got to go here to get a job or whatever, get you off the reservation. So there's all kinds. And with just them coming in and pushing us off of our tribal lands, and that's handed down, whether we realize it or not, it has affected us. From the first time a non-native stepped foot in this land. Because
mm-hmm.
I was 4 years old when I was adopted. That's when the adoption went through. So I already knew who my dad, my mom, my two sisters, my brother were. And we lived in the same town as my father. And it was rough being the only Indian in an all-white school, all-white town. And then my oldest sister was adopted by a farm family out of town and started at school, at the same school. We couldn't talk to each other. If either set of adoptive parents found out we talked to each other, we got beat. We couldn't tell anybody we were sisters, even though everybody knew. Population 639, you don't think they're going to know? You know? And it was just...
Ignorance is
bliss. Stuff like that, you know, and being told every day of my life that I had to start acting like their good little white girl. I'm sorry, but I can't. You know, they took me to White Earth one time to this broken down old shack. And he told me, this is where we're going to leave you if you don't start acting like our daughter. I looked at him, looked at the shack, got out of the car and out through the woods. A mile away was my grandpa's house. It took him a month to find me. But, you know, that's me. I fought every day of my life to maintain who I am, where I came from. Yes, Daddy was Norwegian, so I acknowledge that too. And in doing my genealogy, holy mackerel, I'm Heinz 57. My great-great-great-great-grandfather was the first Swede in Minnesota.
Oh. Swede and Norwegian, huh?
And he was raised as an Anishinaabe. When he came over on the boat with Lord Thomas Selkirk, they stopped up in Hudson Bay. And some of the crew and my grandfather got off to get some fresh food to continue on up into Manitoba.
And the boat took off without him?
He got lost. He was only like 9 years old.
His ship sailed without him?
He couldn't find the crew. He couldn't find the ship.
Did he wander around?
Yeah, he was eating stuff.
Oh, that's good.
And this Anishinaabe family found him and took him in. So he was raised Chinook, Itasca State Park, Lake Ozawindip, and the trails. That's my grandpa.
Right.
Jacob Falstrom was his Swedish name. Ozawindib was the name the Anishinaabe woman gave him, which means yellow hair. And if you ever read Henry Schoolcraft's journal of his expedition to find the source of the Mississippi River, his Indian guide, Ozawindip.
I read that.
And his interpreter was George Bunga, who was my grandpa's brother-in-law. And George's parents were freed slaves from Africa. They were bought down in Jamaica, brought up to Fort Michilimackinac in Michigan. And the Northwest Territory, which included Michigan, abolished slavery in 1797, I think, somewhere in there. So the Bunga family was freed, and they had the first hotel at Fort Michilimackinac. And their son, Pierre, became a fur trader, and he married an Anishinaabe woman and had Marguerite, who married Jacob Ozawindip. And so, Fulstrom and Bungas. Here I am.
It's a good thing he got lost.
Well, yeah.
You wouldn't be here.
Yeah. You know, so there's all that rich history because Grandpa Fulstrom also was a fur trader. And then he became a mail carrier, canoeing all up and down the different rivers and lakes and whatever, delivering mail and joining the expedition and showing him the source of the Mississippi. And then he became a missionary, kind of. He went and saw this one preacher, a Methodist preacher, and he just fell in love with the way he was preaching. So he became, for the tribes, he would go and preach to the tribes in their language. And then he went to farming. And in Afton, there was the Fulstrom farm. And that's where him and Marguerite, some of the kids are buried, and wives and grandkids. And one of my relatives, one of Jacob's and Marguerite's sons, fought in the Civil War.
Yeah, there was actually quite a few people from Chinooks from Minnesota that were fought in the Civil War.
Mm-hmm.
I saw a list of them one time, and there was a Swan, so I asked Mike Swan if that was
his
a relative of his,
goes,
and he was like, yeah.
Yeah.
I was like, well, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
He was like, Zier mentioning that he was a good soldier or something like that, and I was like, is this your relative?
Yeah,
and it was actually, I think a lot of men, but Chinook men have always fought. But
was
there a lot of contingency from Minnesota? And I think Minnesota, not that I'm a Civil War buff or anything like that, but I read that the men from Minnesota were known for their, they were good fighters.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't get lost in the woods. They worked hard. They, you know,
mm-hmm. Yep.
They're good.
Yeah.
Like warriors, I
yeah.
guess. You know?
Isaac didn't die in the war. He died after the war of an illness.
Yeah.
But he's buried out, oh my God, somewhere in Tennessee. I'd have to look at that again, but I've got the certificate for him. And it's just amazing. And there's a site, it's for the Métis. They kept such meticulous records. You can go back, way back, 1700s, 1600s. And that's where I found all the information on the Bungas and Fulstroms.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, because I was researching Grandpa Jacob because I wanted to write a little play about him.
Oh, here's how we got to your artistic, your play of your, about your grandpa.
And it got...
Join us next week as we continue our visit with Juanita, and she will share her sometimes outrageous, sometimes fabulous, and always entertaining experiences in the performing arts and life in general. Have a good week, folks. This program has been funded by the Legacy Arts, Culture, and Heritage Fund of Minnesota.